my God, welcome back to the show. What is happening with this podcast? We just bring people on. You know, we were having a conversation. Siki Chan, welcome back. Kevin, I know that you are our regular, most frequent current host. I am a most frequent past host, but we're here. And so, you know, there's a lot happening in the tech world today. I just got, for me, you know, the big news was the Loom acquisition last week that I did not make money.
Wild.
But that I almost did. And that's deeply troubling. And also that helps a friend of ours, Shahid Khan, and a few other people, including the CEO, have life-changing outcomes, which is amazing. But also the massive decline in venture capital, which is seemingly endless. I don't know how to say it affects you. Let's chat about this and a set of other things. Siki, welcome back.
Hey, good to see you guys. Good to be back.
How have you been, Siki? Are you been heads down?
Yeah, it's been crazy. What was the last time we've been on this?
A few months ago, I think.
May?
Yeah.
April? Yeah, a lot has happened. We launched our website. People started talking about the website, and then we announced our fundraising. And yeah, things have been wild. We've been growing the team, just had an offsite. So it's good to be back. Sorry, I've been away for so long.
No, we're happy to have you.
Talk to me about what it takes to get from a good initial fundraise, which you had, you know, the last time that you were on the show, to now that beginning of scale and investors doubling down. We've all been there at least once, but now big bets have been made on you and on your business. So, you know, talk a little bit about the history of that maybe and talk us through what it took to get to the other side.
Lots of pain. Well, funnily enough, so the round we raised before was 2 years ago. And so Gary Chan led a round right in the middle of Zerp. It was like May of 2021. It was a year after our seed round. And we had a great demo. We pitched him. He gave us an offer we couldn't refuse. And a month later, we're like, yeah, we're throwing that away. We're starting over. We learned some new things.
Wow.
And then that was 2 years ago, right?
Question. Cool. What is it that happened between the initial, you know, you're a repeat and a founder, people get excited, they write big checks, but then initial excitement and then everything really starting to work and people deciding on the investing side to really double down?
It is time. You know, some things just take time. When I look at the modern generation of products, right, like a Figma, Notion, Coda, Airtable, people forget each of them took 3.5 to 5 years to launch, right? Ripley was like 2 years with 40 engineers.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing that changed. We had a pretty good demo year end, showed Vigari, gave us an offer, could refuse, and we kind of had to start over because we realized that the value is elsewhere. And to unlock that value, you basically had to build like half of Excel, a good chunk of Notion, and then a good chunk of Workato to integrate all of the data sources.
It took two. So your first fundraising is 2 years ago. It, you know, your second repeat founder, there's so much hype initially. I remember I felt that Kevin had some, you had some. Everyone's these guys, the boy genius is back.
Yeah.
But now it's like people are starting to really double down. What does it take to get there after the initial hype cycle?
It takes time. I mean, you know, there are some classes of problems that just take a long time to unlock the value of. And people forget that if you look at the modern generation of SaaS products really made it, the Notion, Figma, Airtable, Codas of the world, even Ripley. Ripley was like 2+ years to launch, but it was another year before it really started working. The other products I mentioned were 3.5 to 5 years. That's just how long it took. And so for us, we had this demo that initially was quite compelling, but as we talked to more customers, we realized that the problem was elsewhere. It wasn't about reporting, it was about forecasting. And to unlock that, we had to basically build a good chunk of Excel and half of Notion and then integrate with 400 different sources of data that you end up using just to get your foot in the door.
Right.
And that was basically the last 2 years. And now that we have something, you know, if you have the table stakes and have a differentiated vision and value, that's, it started to work. But it took to get there, it just took a tremendous amount of pain and time.
So we're so good at talking about this. I'm going to use this for the next fundraising. Thank you for this little bit. Well, if sound bites are really high value, whoever's listening to this, please listen to those sound bites again. Kevin, go ahead.
I'm going to say there was a few things that you mentioned in there. So one was like the time to really find the value that you provide your customers. And then the other piece was the time that it actually took to build the product, right? I think that people kind of forget like the initial like MVP, like LinkedIn, get it out the door no matter what. When you like compare, I think things are different even from a technology standpoint, because there was nothing else before LinkedIn, right? Now, if you're building what you're building, Siki, and what Julian, what you're building, what I'm building, there's already so many other competitors. So you already have such a huge, and also what's all the other companies you mentioned, like Codad and Figma and all those, you have so much to build to get to have a better actual product. But then you also have, then you also have the journey to figure out like why you're better than everything else. So I think it's if I'm kind of dissecting what you said, it's like a two-part problem that.
Yeah, totally.
And then did that, so walk us through the fundraising. So you raised from Gary Tan for just a demo. And then you just recently, over the last 6 months or so, raised more money after you've kind of unlocked this value for customers, I'm assuming.
No.
Well,
here's some tea.
Okay.
We announced a round that happened 2 years ago.
Oh.
Huh?
Yeah.
You even tricked us. We're like, oh, shit. This is
amazing.
We tricked at least one of them. Sure. So you're like, oh, congratulations. Gary doubled down. And the same round that you just invested in 2 years ago. They're like, oh, okay.
Oh, my God. That's awesome. Yeah.
What you're saying is right. First of all, here's what we all learn. And I think in all three of our businesses, the actual competitor is Excel. Is that right? Because for me, that's definitely true. For you, it's true. You just, you know, said it. And Kevin, the previous version was Excel kind with of, a guy working on it.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah,
that's how powerful a spreadsheet is.
That's
and
amazing.
We're all just trying to beat, you know, a $99 a year user license from Microsoft. That's okay.
True.
You know,
it's
but
true.
It just really shows efficiency. It also sounds like you, the user type is a little bit different than you expected. And the workflows are different. You know, you're right. Figma, tons of time to build.
Yeah.
Software is just harder. I'm thinking back to the early days of Breather, like instant product market fit came with negative margins that eventually got to 30% margins. Kevin, your quote unquote instant product market fit happened with negative margins and stayed that way, as you confessed on this show. To get
we
like,
got to break
margin
even.
Business.
We got to break even.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't listening back, but you get it. So, but the point is, to get to an 85% margin business, like you got to drive a lot of fucking value on a really consistent basis to get to a business that is great.
Well, also you have to like, don't forget about the growth component of that as well, right? You obviously have to have great operating margins and all of those different things, but the growth and also the sustained growth. I know one of the topics we had on here is like really finding product market fit. I don't know, Sihi, if you think you guys have that.
Oh, no.
No?
We have non-zero of it, right? So we're running the business as a superhuman, AngelList, Lob, a bunch of like pretty significant companies, and they're loving the product. So
that's
you
awesome.
Know, you never, well, like look, product market fit to whom, right? To the entire universe of companies, definitely not. To companies around 50 to 500 people.
Sarah's crashing. And also, we're having a lot of technical difficulties. So Siki keeps on freezing. We don't know.
I don't know what's happening.
We don't know what's happening. But we're trying to figure out if Siki has product market fit with Runway or even what that actually is.
He is right. Product market fit, this is seductive, okay? Because product market fit is this thing, it's really clearly defined by Marc Andreessen, okay? And then everyone messes with it. It's for whom, for what, all these things. I think I have a bunch of coaching clients and I talk with a lot of them about this because lots of them are in that product market fit for whom phase. And I really believe the product market fit, when you have it, feels explosive.
like really explosive. But what Mark Andreessen doesn't talk about in that article is he doesn't say product market fit is explosive. And in order to have the explosion, your go-to-market needs to be lined up.
Yes.
They don't say that because you brought that up, Kevin, a moment ago. The growth has to happen. Yeah. But that's if the fucking market is pulling it out of you constantly. Yep. I heard from another customer that you said this and that you deliver this now. I've been waiting for this for years, et cetera, et cetera. So that's if that pull is just incredible and the word of mouth is unreal. But the other thing is to get to a supposed product market fit that Mark Andreessen is talking about, it requires the go-to-market to really be lined up. People are hearing about it.
Yep.
People want it and they are desperate. How do you even find these people? How do they find you? All of that is inferred in his article that he originally wrote, not explicitly stated.
And what is that road to that product market fit? So we talked about Siki mentioning as he had to build, basically change the customer he was selling to. Also, Sarah has talked about her similar experiences. And then also building a whole new product as well. Mm-hmm. And then you have to build the go-to-market function, like you're talking about, yep. Jillian, that it's either going to be some sort of viral component, if it's consumer, it has to be, or it's going to be some sort of marketing component, or it's going to be some sort of combination, potentially marketing, SDR, outbound sales led. And I think that when all those things align, in my opinion, that's when you truly have product market fit. And then you can really use the venture dials to really crank that up and to really grow as a sustainable place and potentially unprofitably as well.
Sure. Yeah. And so the go-to-market function, Siki, is it obvious yet? That is the next thing after the customer wants it. Everything kind of needs to be in tandem. My metric, I often think back to this 9-point or whatever venture capital talk that they have about mice customers all the way up to whale customers. That is always my metric for SaaS. I see Sarah nodding a little bit. You have mice customers. If so, it's got to be viral. If you have deer customers, cold outbound might work. It might not. Talk to me about your heuristics in terms of what it is to line it all up a little bit.
Yeah. Well, our ACVs are in the 5-digit range. So, you know, it's somewhere in the middle. And
why do I keep frozen doing again? This
I don't know. God. I think it's Siki.
It's definitely Siki. We're all here.
Yeah. it's me, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you want to?
I don't know.
Can you shut off your camera?
That's a great way.
Maybe I'll do that. All right. Let's try better.
Okay. Talk to me about the go-to-market. Siki, talk to me about the go-to-market functions. What does it take to line it all up? Do you have some heuristics for us to be able to understand it better?
You know, we're still in the process of getting to general availability. We do have a sales team in place, a sales leader. But for me, the key metrics is like, how many deals, what percentage of deals are we winning, right? So typically in SaaS, a benchmark is you want to win 20% of the meetings that you have.
Yep.
And right now, you know, we're many times higher than that. And so we think that we built a product that people want. The problem is, can we actually address the demand as we go up market? We kind of have this strategy of wanting to steamroll the market when we are generally available. And so the way I think about this is product market fit is sort of this 2D graph. It's you can either be on the tracks towards it or not on the track. You kind of know what you're doing. And then once you're on the track, can you see the things that you have left to build in order to really cross the chasm? And for us, I think we're probably about 6 months away from really crossing the chasm and being able to scale this up. We have, at the early stages, I think what you want to look for is sales market fit. Like the thing that you're selling, is it something that people want? Can you show them something that people want? And if that's substantially high, like higher than 20%, then you need to just go as fast as possible, grow the team and build the thing that people want. And that's kind of where we are today.
That's so interesting. I really read something I learned recently in both of the businesses that I had, Breather in the past and here at Practice. Sales functions occurred as a result of us realizing that sales was an effective channel versus the snowflake method, which is just, we're going to sell this from day one. I think people on the internet are often obsessed with self-serve in PLG when they probably should not yeah. be. And so here, what we're looking at is, okay, what is that win rate? And Lenny pointed this out in a recent article where he talks about how to get your first 10 B2B customers. And he talks about product market fit being, if you can do cold emails from day one, then holy crap, that really is product market fit, that random people will answer your email and say, holy crap, yes, that's the thing. That's the thing that I wanted. How did you know about that?
Yeah.
And if you have that, then that's excellent. I think lots of founders don't think about this because of this obsession that people have with viral building, like a fucking, you know, a nightclub app or whatever the hell people do in their 20s.
Yeah. You know, that's been one of the big learnings for me throughout this process, right? This is my first B2B company. And I think one of the super unintuitive things about go to market with B2B is, you know, all of your instincts as a founder on like, what is good, right? What do you want? You want to be able to just use the product, sign up for free,
right?
But what's more apparent to you as you build for other demographics is that we are really different. We're not the same as a typical like economic buyer in a larger enterprise. They expect to talk to a salesperson and they expect there to be implementation if your product is sufficiently complicated. And so it's really interesting. I think it's not really a competitor, but you know, Equals is like the spreadsheet Google Sheets with integrations. And they recently announced that they are dialing back the free tier. They tried making it free and they said it didn't work. And it's for very similar reasons. Their buyer is just super, super different, right? To get something like that working, you need to have access to the general ledger, to the HR systems, and it's just not the same as someone signing up for Figma.
I would say that I'm definitely in probably even a higher ACV than you are, Siki, and that people actually they want and need to talk to somebody. Like you will not get like a self serve, nor do we want to. We also, because we actually have partners on the other side, we actually want to weed out the customers that we don't think that are actually going to be good customers for our partners.
Yeah.
And also we just won't get people that would self-serve up unless they are just starting out. And so people want to get on the phone with us. They want to talk through everything. They're doing this with 20 other, because we're in a very competitive space. Of course, we are 10 times better. And I believe that. But we still have lots of competitors. I'm sure you do too. And you also compete with Excel. With Runway, I actually use an outsource accounting firm, and they built something similar to what you have, and it's all Excel-based,
right.
And it's like spits out all of these reports for your board and all this stuff, but you have a lot of competitors too, and so when your ACV is so high, like you should have a sales team, like you need to have a sales team, and I think it's so different than even with Julian, like what you're dealing with. I know that like in your lowest tier, like you have, are you looking for a PLG motion?
It's a good question. Yeah. Cheryl, also, I'm going to queue her up after my answer to you.
Yes.
What we unlocked recently is we unlocked big for us, definitely big for us team transactions that are really meaningful and that really affect the trajectory of the business. And what I was always, I think there is a death zone. It's my perspective.
Yeah.
There's a death zone of PLG where all that you do is you sell to individuals, at which point gotta get to the other side of that churn rate. It's just incredibly difficult. The natural churn rate of these businesses, Sarah knows this, she serves small businesses as well as the larger ones. Those small businesses, they just die on their own at 30% per year. So your churn rate is at least 30% per year.
There's like SMB is hard for a number of reasons. One, the businesses die, but two, like they, you know, I think we want them to be self-serve, but they often want the same amount of touches as an enterprise customer. Like they may not have the same number of decision makers to get on board, but they may need nearly, like the thing we found is small daycares could take the same amount of touches as a really big seven-figure ACV.
That's crazy.
And so, you know, for us, we just had to prioritize and say, we can't, these SMEs need to be self-serve, or we just can't support that business because it just, we can't make the math work, or at least the math isn't going to work out as well as a big enterprise customer, and putting salespeople on that versus putting salespeople on SMB or even smaller.
Totally agree.
And also just
go ahead.
Just to put a point on that for Sarah, you have a really interesting model, because the daycares that you are bringing on, the small ones, they typically don't grow into become these larger daycares, right? Which is completely different than if you're Figma or you're wherever, or you're AWS or something like that, where you have somebody that they could be spending like whatever, like $5,000 a year with you, and then they're going to build a big business on it. So you really are like really custom. It's like you have two completely different segments of customers. Like you have the super SMB that you like, you can't ever talk to them. Or you have the 100,000 ACV customers. We also have something similar. It's actually in the middle. So we work with e-commerce brands. So we'll have brands that they'll come in and they'll spend five grand a month with us, and they'll be doing whatever, I don't know, 50 grand a month in sales. And they will just, some of them will just stay there and they won't grow. But we'll also have relaunch customers that actually we've seen some of our biggest customers grow within a year to be spending like hundreds of thousands of dollars with us. And so we're actually trying to evaluate up front, like how do you determine if a customer is going to actually grow or not? Because some of them won't.
Yeah.
But I think that if we kind of wrap this all up, it's every single business is different. And this is kind of how you find product market fit. Like, how do you find the go-to-market? You have to figure this stuff out. Like Sarah, obviously it took you a long time. It's like, you have these SMB customers that want to talk to somebody, and like, you want to talk to them, but you're like, we just can't make the economics
SMB, work.
SMB,
like, it's just 99 out of 100 times, it's not going to work, and you're going to chase it for a long time because it feels like a thing you can move. Ooh, I sent an email and we got this many more subscribers, or I changed this thing and reduced your churn, but it's so much harder going after the top.
People do not.
Yeah.
You know, if you grew up in any city or anywhere else in San Francisco, really, you do not understand the power of the billboard between San Francisco and Palo Alto. Okay. And so those billboards, what are those companies? Year one of being a startup founder, I'm like, what the fuck are these companies? Who's buying from this billboard? Year two, year three. Some of the billboards have changed, but some are still there. Some have more billboards. Holy fuck, they are finding something that works on the billboard side. Year five, I start to understand. I've been a startup CEO for 10 years. A few of us, Kevin, I know you're approaching that time.
Yep.
I 100% believe in those billboards today. And now I'm like, when you're building a thing for small businesses, you want to root for the little guy, you're a little guy, all these other things. So I think that there is a death. If you're only following the small businesses, I think it's really difficult. I think the answer to PLG is PLG leads to enterprise deals.
Yes.
And so if you have three, have three, but holy fuck, you better be driving values for that three. And that death zone is really tough. Shiki, I think hopefully you could hear us. And
yeah, I can. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I'm reflecting on early on the year one runaway as we pursued sort of the PLG path for finance, right? Oh, I'm a startup. There's lots of startups.
Let's
build something anyone could just sign up to and get some value in. And that's the thing that we rotated off of a year in. And what one of the big learnings is, you know, product market fit is path dependent, in that if you start with something PLG that's free, you will attract people of who can get value from that. Those are like small teams, small startups. Those are small teams, small startups, and that feedback will inflect the product that you end up building for the enterprise.
Yes,
and it's going to delay your roadmap.
Yeah. Yeah.
For a lot and for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so deciding who your customer should be up front, it turns out to be incredibly important, because you can't just random walk it. You will get there.
Yeah. So, I really believe this. You know, you're pointing out that's very sharp. That's actually like listening to Chris Dixon here or listening to or the random walk theory. Both of them, you're looking at them and you're saying, oh, but I'll just listen to what's happening. Your ears are pointed in the wrong direction. What you need to, these people, these sales-oriented CEOs, in lots of cases, they're literally just like, I'm just going to fucking follow the millions of dollars that want this. And if I don't find millions of dollars, I'm going to give up until I find a thing that wants to give me millions of dollars. And meanwhile, we're all obsessed. It's a huge error. It's a huge false death fact pattern.
Yeah.
In startups, I listen to the blog posts and I'm going to make a company that sounds like the blog posts.
Yeah.
No, completely wrong. Always invest, by the way, if you're an angel investor or you want to be one and you want to listen to this, and always invest in the sales oriented founders. If you have a sales oriented founder, always invest in them. Yes. They're going to get financed because they know how to sell.
Yep.
And they know how to sell. Those are the ones that really, so long as they have a tech founder alongside them, those are the dimensions that you want.
Yeah. Siki, I'm curious, how nice is it to now have $100,000 ACV customers?
I mean, we don't have anyone that high. They're five digits, mid-five digits.
But it, obviously, it'll grow up from there. But more or less, like, instead of, like, initially it sounded like you were looking to bring on some smaller customers and have them grow with you, but, like, how nice is it to have somebody to pay you? I don't know if what your model is up front or what, like yearly or whatever, but like that there's a big chunk and change that like once you get this engine really running, and that's why I think that once you've been in consumer and you went to B2B and especially you went to enterprise B2B, it's just holy shit. I just need to figure out this product and I just need to sell to like tens of customers or hundreds of customers. And I have a $1 billion business. It's pretty remarkable. I'm definitely addicted to it.
I don't love it, to be honest with you.
You don't love it.
I am the founder that Julian says you shouldn't invest in. I don't like.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
You know, I feel like I'm decent at sales, but I like building products, man. I like building stuff that's nice and people find elegant and all of that. And so you should never invest in me. So I would rather people just pick it up and, you know, be able to use it. It's just not the nature of the product. I will say the thing that is really nice is it's just nice to have something that works.
Right.
That's amazingly nice, right? The gap between you're just trying to figure out if anyone even wants it to. People do want it. They're willing to pay you lots of money. And once they pay you, they're not going to stop. It feels amazing.
Yeah.
Eric and Phil.
Yeah.
Sarah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely not the sales-oriented founder either, but I would argue that, like, you do need both. Like, a really amazing sales-oriented founder can, like, you know, they'll raise tons of money and they'll sell you on everything, but then they'll have some kind of fraud product in the background. You need actually work and do the job and be amazing to keep people retained and build a business long-term. So I think it's a combination. You can't be so good at sales that you're selling a grift. I mean, that's what we've seen. You know, that was Never Know Story. That's SBF. That's like, these are amazing salespeople, but they had no product sense and they didn't care about what they were building. I personally would invest in someone who could sell enough, who could articulate their vision, but really was a product-oriented founder who was going to build the real thing that was going to make customers happy in the long run.
So question here, I think we may be getting the sales definition a little wrong. When I heard Julian say sales focused founder, I thought the person who really wanted to create a sales team and go and sell the product to the customer. And I think that I've went from consumer, my last company, and now I'm addicted to the sales side of things. Like I'm in the big deals. I want to get that deal. I'm like in the background with that director of sales, like what the fuck can we do to sell this customer? I'm addicted to it now, looking at the conversion rates and exactly. So you can mention from opportunity to actually a closed lead, like 20% is, I know that cold. That's what a SaaS product should be like. I love building products. And so What's a good example of that? I think that like Parker Conrad would be a good example of that. He kind of is a sales driven founder, right? Like he is all obsessed. I'd say he's an amazing salesperson to raise as much money as he has. I think he's a good salesperson as far as attracting a lot of people. And he's also like, they built a really great product. We use Rippling. It's a great product. So that's when Julian spoke of a sales driven founder. That's what I kind of thought, versus just like selling fake like shit that doesn't
actually work.
Wasn't
he previously like the founder of that company Zenefits that was doing all this like illegal fraud stuff?
Yeah, I think
I'm going.
What's
back,
your point?
Like, you're too good at sales. All you do is the grift. I want some real thoughtful humans. I would invest in a real thoughtful human that is thinking about what's best for the universe any day over.
I think you could have both.
Sales grifter.
I think you could have both. Let's not pigeonhole everybody into one thing, okay? Like right now, I love products.
Yes, for like blowing up and then coming back and being able to raise a lot of money and do it all again. Like,
well, okay, I'm a user of Rippling. I'm a super happy user. They have the great product. It has some issues early on, but it's a great product now. So I'll just speak to that. But you also have a lot of these like other B2B like sales leaders. Look at the massive companies that are public, right? Like those are typically like those are sales leaders, and they also may have a really good product sense as well. Like I think of somebody like an Aaron Levy from Box, right? Like I think of him as he is like product oriented. Box has, I think, been it's been a good enterprise product, right? I don't know if you guys have used that. I definitely have, and we do use it. But he's all about like the sales efficiency. All like he's flying in to close customer deals. He's also flying in to save customers from churning and all that. That's what I kind of think of as a sales driven founder. But I think you could have all of these different traits. So Julian's point: invest into somebody that actually has all of them. That wants to get that deal closed. That loves the building the product.
Here's the thing: I'm just gonna point out some patterns. Okay. And so the listener and here on the panel, we can figure out which one we are, and I know which one I am. And so the first one is you have a technical founder. The technical founder has a very minimal product sense. They're really much more of a technical founder than anything else. And their common error, okay, their most common error is I'm going to build a technology and I'm looking for a user for that technology. And they never ultimately find it. That's
the
technical
AI
founder
startups.
Error.
This is
many AI startups.
AI startup
or
right now.
This,
I'm with
totally
you, Sarah.
Right. Now you have the sales founder. And actually the sales founder, there is a trap, but it's a totally different one. And I think you pointed out to some degree, is if you're too good at sales, you will actually sell into a thing, but they like you. And they actually don't like the product. But they're going to buy it for you anyway. I was just on with Jake Dunlap, who runs a sales scaling company called Scaled, actually. And he was like, are they buying? He was asking me based on my users, are they buying based on the relationship or are they buying based on the problem?
Right.
The problem is the early sales founders, I see Siki Inade. It's like those sales founders, they sell based on a relationship, but there's actually no product behind it. And the product-oriented founders is that they believe the product will solve everything. And so I'm sure everyone here has fallen into some of those traps.
Yeah.
And the listener, I'm sure, will hopefully be able to find which one they are. Siki.
This is a very second time founder specific problem, right? This hit us early in Runway, because the second time around, people will try your shitty thing just because you're you. And they'll say nice things. And it's very difficult to get early signal from that. It's not until you talk to people, you have to go look for people you don't know. Or get someone who they don't know to sell it for you to really get good signal early on. That definitely.
With a free product. Like we had a free product at Winnie in the beginning and people were just nice.
Right.
Because why complain about something that's free?
Yeah.
As soon as you ask people to pay money, they start giving some real feedback. And you can see it in their willingness to pay money and their willingness to retain.
Do we want to move to another topic that CP actually came up with?
Go ahead.
Okay. Do you want to talk, Siki? You mentioned you just came off from an offsite. talk to us about how that was. We're, I'm assuming, all here, mostly having remote companies. How was that? How did it go? What did you do? All those things.
Yeah, I'm curious how everyone else does it. I really enjoyed our last one. This is our fourth offsite. We did do it about twice a year. This time we had a place in Napa, which if you're over 25, actually, if you're over 25 in team size, I wouldn't recommend. We had to split the team up into three different locations and have transportation. So it wasn't great, but I think the thing that really worked out well is the balance between work and a social time. You know, when you think about the two goals of an offsite, you want people who haven't seen each other to have some FaceTime, get to know each other and bond. Some people make it that entire offsite. We didn't. And the other thing that we do in particular was we try to make sure everyone's aligned on the strategy for the next 3 to 6 months. And we found that the balance is like we actually ended up doing about 2/3 content around that and about 1/3 bonding time. And that was the right balance for us. We had a house, people came in, we brought a customer in, people interviewed the customer.
Oh, awesome.
So it was like really great vibes. And we had a great, we have a great executive team. So like the executive team, the Socratic method to communicate a strategy. Like, here's a situation, here's the constraints. What would you do? And everyone arrived the same answer sort of independently. And so I really enjoyed it. I'm curious to hear how other people's experience have been with offsites and what's worked well or what hasn't.
I mean, I'll give some, a couple of comments real quick. Like, first, choose a good city. It's really important that people be able to go off into teams on their own.
Yes.
And so I had one in Portugal at some point in our last year. And in the past, you've had them in Montreal and in New York. At Breather, we have tons of cities, so go to them wherever. But then they can create their own situation, and they can go out and create their own experience. If you choose to have it inside a hotel, the hotel can have many different breakout situations. And so that way people can go into room A, room B, room C, give every team leader the ability to be with his or her or their team privately without the other leadership team involved, so that they can really feel like they're getting to know the team and they're creating trust. And especially in a remote company, when you create trust, it builds bonds that you can then rely on in hard times.
How long?
Sarah, what do you do?
For us, we arrived Monday evening and some people left Thursday evening, late nights, but most of the people from out of town left Friday morning. So it was a whole week.
Yeah, we have not done a whole company offsite since we went remote. We've had like individual folks get together or clusters of folks get together, but we have not done a whole company offsite.
How long has it been since you went remote?
2020.
Wow.
Walk us through that decision.
It's more like a non-decision. It's a lot of work and effort, I think, to make it happen as well as cost. And it just hasn't been something that I felt like we should focus on. I think there are a number of people that really do crave like in person. And so for those folks, generally, they've sought out opportunities, whether it's traveling with a small group to visit a customer or getting together at my house to do a day of planning, which we've done a few times. And then there's a number of folks that like I just can tell are not interested. It would be pulling teeth to get them to come. And so it's really just not been a priority, but I know there's so much value in person, you know, because I see it when we visit our customers. So I know team would really benefit, but it's expensive and time consuming to organize and do. So we just haven't prioritized it.
It definitely is. We've done a few different ones. So the last one, where did we go to? San Diego, and we did the hotel one. So there was, and we did lots of activities. I'd say one of the learnings there, I think we went too much on the activities and not enough on the work side of things. So it was probably like 2/3 social, 1/3 actually getting work done. We obviously did the planning and all of that, but it was more like get to know all of, and this is actually after we raised our A. And so everybody was really new and we want everybody to gel and all of that. And so some of the learnings was, I think you definitely need to pick a place that like cost is definitely an issue. Like when you have people from, they're flying from wherever. Like, we only hire people from the US and Canada. And so even from that, fly everybody to one place. We have 1/3 of people in the Bay. That would be the cheapest. Most likely, we went to San Diego to kind of have some fun with it. But it's really expensive for hotels and flights and all of that. So pick a place probably closest for everybody, honestly. That's, even if you do want to do it, Portugal sounds amazing, Jillian. Might only be like applicable for like smaller teams. I think we did Sonoma when we were really small and we had some farmhouses and everybody was still on the same property. That was cool. I think it really depends on the size of your team, but I think that it's great to get to know people. And I think that the energy that you get coming off these offsites really is, it's infectious. It definitely does wear off after a month or two, but for that like month or two afterwards, I think people are really kind of jazzed up. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good, it's a good thing to do. I do wonder, I know the whole remote work plus offsites was a way to potentially save money. I don't think that's actually the case. Like, having people, even considering salaries of the Bay Area, like, if you're going to do maybe like quarterly offsites,
right,
that's fucking expensive. Like, flying people and all that, like, versus having everybody in person, right? Like, we're no longer in COVID and we can all get together. So I'm actually like pivoting towards hiring more people in the Bay. We're going to be getting an office. We have an office in Oakland right now. We have a lot of people in the East Bay. We'll be getting an office in SF. And I'm going to be hiring more of the next generation of team in the actual city. And then we will do offsites and bring people in that are still remote into the Bay Area. I just don't really see the huge cost savings, honestly, and the benefits. And I'm a super extrovert. I love being, and maybe that's me personally, I love being in person with people. Even if it was once a week, we do that every week here still with the people in the Bay. We get together at least once a week. I want to go back to that world, not a huge fan of the remote work. And I really don't think that there is a ton of cost savings. And I think that there is a huge, and this is my personal opinion, I think that you just get more done in person and there's more collaboration. There's more.
You know, yeah.
I know you're Julian is you're the complete opposite.
No, I'm agreeing with you. I'm saying there's conditions in which, as your ACV goes up, Siki, right? Because what's gonna happen, this is always a worry of mine. We're okay today. We're doing deals and we're doing them remote, right? Like, we're doing them on Zoom. But you could see where there's a certain deal size where you just have to become an in-person company or at least have some in-person component. And I'm wondering, early on in the PLG section, you're building a PLG company. You could be wherever, you're Calendly, right? Who cares? But as your business gets more and more deal oriented, I wonder if the business gets more.
You mean like
in person
with customers or in person with your team on an offsite?
I think
that's my question too.
Once you have one team starting to see people, it's going to start to pull towards in person gradually. You're not going to get some dude who's like randomly out there doing 250K deals. And he's just flying everywhere and everyone else just stays on their couch. That seems
strange. That's what we do. I mean, we have like sales and success and me, we fly everywhere. Like I had a goal to be in every week.
Same.
But like the engineers and the product managers, you know, maybe product a little bit to meet customers, but it's all in the vein of meeting customers. Like, we are flying to places. We are not flying to get together for a team offsite. And we're, you know, trying to make that our opportunities to also hang out with each other. But it's like, we, you know, next week I'm going to Florida and then New York and I'll meet teammates there in those destinations.
To tell you the truth, I'm really glad to hear that I'm being proven wrong on this, because it was a worry of mine that as deal size would go up, that the company would become a hybrid.
Scattered, because then they're, you know, it's just easier to make connections. Like, we can say, oh, like, you're in DC. We have a team member there too. We should hang out. Then you can connection.
Yeah, we do that.
So it's definitely not cheaper. Like, it's actually more expensive all told. Cause, you know, we have two offices. We have one in New York and one here.
Right.
Because people want to go to office a couple of times a week, but, you know, they're not all in the same city. Then we have offsites twice a year and people fly in between. So, meaningfully more expensive, but we try to not be super religious about it. We just try to do what we can to hire the best people and, you know, give them an environment that they prefer, whether that's in person or not.
I think my perspective is, I think that there are certain groups that really are better in person. I would say anything like creatively is better in person if you kind of, and maybe that's 1 to 3 days a week in person. And then also to Sarah's point, like as your ACV does go up, like we're flying, we have a sales team and they're flying sales and operations team, and they're flying to both our partners and our customers all the time. And so that's going to be a continuing process. But I think that other teams, like having a sales team centralized to kind of get that camaraderie, I don't know if that's something you need to do yet or not, but I think, and also you can get really great salespeople that you could actually sell a lot on Zoom, and then you go in for the final close, like in person or something like that, if it actually is like a really high ACV deal. I think there's a lot of different ways, but I think that it really depends on your business model and your type of customer and like all those different things. And also I still believe I live in the Bay Area, because I want to, like, when you get to that growth stage, I want to get like all of the best growth people to, when we hit our B and C and D rounds, like I really want to take advantage of what is here and try to be in person. So that's my perspective. So I definitely think that's a massive benefit. That's the reason I moved here from Canada, was to take advantage of that.
Yeah. Closing thought, everyone. I was wondering, you know, we just, if you try to think about, I know, Sarah, you're out of the VC world and we're all very happy for
I'm
you.
Out of the VC world.
The remainder of us.
For now. No, she said now. Well, she's profitable
I'm
now.
I'm invited by VCs. They're what all is on my cap table.
True. Yeah, you're stuck with them. What is y'all's thinking about fundraising? It's actually becoming even more difficult, is what I'm seeing. People keep saying, I think this is the bottom, and then it's not. What are we seeing in 1 minute or less?
Horrible.
It's terrible. But I don't know if we're not at the bottom yet or not.
It will get worse.
I can't believe this. That's inflation. Shiki, go ahead. Depends on stage. I don't know. I'm seeing signs of life. I don't know. My thesis is that Sam Altman is going to cancel the recession. There's lots of downward pressure, but AI is a huge lever. And that's kind of what we're seeing in the market today.
Got it. Very interesting. Well, I think we ended on that. Very thoughtful, provocative statements all around. Thank you for those that joined. Thank you to those of you that are listening, and tune in next week when another bunch of randos give their opinions about tech and try to get you to learn something.
With better internet. With way better internet next time.
Yeah.
Way better internet.
Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next time.
Bye, folks.